Hello, you're listening to The History of Now, a podcast run from the History Faculty of the University of Cambridge, or more precisely from a locked down living room just north of the River Cam. Well, locked down is perhaps exaggerating now that many restrictions have been lifted in the UK, but like many others, I'm still trying to minimize my exposure to infection by avoiding indoor crowds. I'm Chris Clark, and this podcast is about how the past can help us to think about the present. And right now we're running a series of episodes on issues related to the crisis triggered by the current COVID-19 pandemic. My conversation partner today is Simon Schretter, professor in history and public policy and history faculty at the University of Cambridge. His main fields of research are demographic history, public health, economic and social history, and he's the author of celebrated and prize-winning books, including Fertility, Class and Gender in Britain, 1860 to 1940, which came out with Cambridge University Press in 1996, and Sex Before the Sexual Revolution, Intimate Life in England, 1918 to 1963, co-authored with Kate Fisher, which also came out with Cambridge in 2010. But our conversation today has much more to do with a very recent publication by Professor Schretter and by a co-author, Kevin Sienna, an article forthcoming in the Economic History Review. And its title is The Pox in Boswell's London, An Estimate of the Extent of Syphilis Infection in the Metropolis in the 1770s. And that's what we'll be talking about today. James Boswell, the celebrated biographer of Samuel Johnson, left a candid report of his sexual exploits on his many trips to London while working as a lawyer from the 1760s until he settled in the capital with his family in 1786. And at one point, he reports having had sexual congress with, and these are his words, a strong, jolly young damsel on Westminster Bridge, just for the heck of it. But his diary also, sadly, records up to 19 episodes of venereal disease, most contracted through commercial sex transactions rather than from adulterous or extramarital liaisons. So there was clearly quite a bit of casual sex going on and quite a bit of venereal disease in London. Yet epidemiological historians of epidemics, have rarely tackled sexually transmitted infections. Simon, why is that?
Hello, Chris. Yes, I think that the big issue for epidemiological and demographic historians is, of course, quantitative evidence. They have a wonderful armory of statistically based methods for interrogating disease and population change in the past, but they need data and censuses and vital registers and bills of mortality and so on provide a lot of this data, and it's been worked over very well. But when we come to the sexually transmitted diseases, the evidence is much more difficult to come by. There were very few official sort of sources. And of course, on the whole, neither people nor doctors particularly wanted to talk about this. There was a lot of shame attached to it. And so finding actual quantitative evidence has been tricky. But by contrast, there's quite a lot of evidence if we look at literary and cultural sources, cartoons and diaries like they are exceptional, but you get diaries such as Boswell's and so on. So there are literary sources. The big problem, of course, for demographers and epidemiologists is the big issue is how representative these kinds of this sort of material is, and whether it's just telling us about individual idiosyncratic experiences, about the views of an elite or the practices of an elite. It's very, very hard to know without quantitative data whether this is telling us something that is happening in society more generally, or is evidence of more idiosyncratic kind, which I think. So this is, I think, why we have a fantastic demographic and epidemiological history, particularly of England, going right back to the 16th century. But it's all been done as if STIs never existed. Now, that's not because the demographers don't, they know it existed, but they just have no methods for dealing with it.
They had no handle on it. Now, before we come back to the question, as I do want to come back to the question of how you count something like a disease like syphilis, but first of all, could you tell us something about what syphilis is? It was known in the 18th century as the pox. It's a complex disease. It manifests in phases. In each phase, it seems to have different symptoms. What is it exactly?
Yes, well, it wasn't until 1905 that Fritz Schaudin actually found the microorganism that is the cause of it, Treponema pallidum, a little spiral organism, transparent, which is why it was so hard to see. But finally, it was isolated and discovered. It is transmitted by inoculation into the bloodstream through very small abrasions or whatever. Usually when people have sexual intercourse, and once into the bloodstream, it will cause a small rash, often at the site where the abrasion was, where it originally entered the body. But then not an awful lot for a few days, maybe even a week or two. But then once it starts reproducing and circulating in the bloodstream, it will enter the secondary phase, which is anything from 2 to 4 weeks after the original inoculation, at which point most people begin to feel moderately or often very unwell. It causes fevers, it causes pain in joints, and it goes on, unfortunately, typically for many weeks, in the sense of 2 to 3 months, and it can be longer than that, and it can then relapse as well, until finally the body's immunological defenses find a way of dealing with the bacterium and containing it. It's not really got rid of, it's just contained by the body, which is why for a proportion of those infected, anything from 5 to 25 years later, there may be a breakout of the contained disease. It may have, and if it has got into certain of the body's organisms, the brain, the spinal cord, or the heart valve, it can then actually cause death. But this will often happen even a decade or several decades after the actual incident of the original infection.
There's an expression, tertian fever. Is that?
Yes. There's a sort of convention of talking about primary, secondary, and tertiary phases, where the primary is the initial inoculation, the secondary is the phase that most people are very, very uncomfortably aware of when they're feeling so bad. And tertiary, then there's the period of latency, as it's called, when it's contained by the body. And then the tertiary phase is if it remanifests itself at some point later in life, because the body has become weaker and less able to contain the spirochetes. Then it can, cause this potentially fatal damage.
Now, in your study of the disease, you and Kevin Siena come to the conclusion, it's an estimate, but it's a robust estimate, that approximately 20% of the adult population of London was living with syphilitic infection.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
That result?
So what the exact nature of the measure is, that we have found that if you were an adult living in London between the age of 15 and 35, so the first 20 years of your sexually mature adult life.
Yeah.
If you were living in London continuously through all that period, on average, it appears from our data that you would have had about a 20% chance, 21% chance of having submitted yourself for pox treatment to one of the several institutions in London offering such treatment. So if, for instance, you were an adult who didn't arrive in the capital until your early to mid 20s, but you were still, and then you were still there at the age of 35, you might have about a half of that chance, about a 10% chance. If you were someone who left the capital in your late 20s or mid 20s, you might also have about a half of that chance. And the mobility of the London population is an important part of, you know, what's going on here and why the rate is so high. Lots and lots of young London was growing far strongly. A big source of its growth is young adults coming into London looking for work, partly because they're being pushed off the countryside by the enclosure movement that's quite strong at this time, and partly because London has got jobs to offer. The problem for the young adults is that the jobs on offer are often somewhat insecure and irregular, and they don't necessarily have good sources of support, because although there's something called the Poor Law in England at this time, which is actually an extraordinary system of universal support, you have to be in your parish of settlement, as it was called, which for many people is the parish you were born into, in order to qualify for that support. So if you've moved to London and gone maybe 30, 20 or even 60, 70, 80 miles away, and you're in London and you've lost your job, or you're without a source of support, particularly if you're a young woman in that position, then the desperate need to earn some income could push you into seeing if this is a way to earn some quick money to keep going for a while until you can find a more secure form of income.
This brings me to my next question, which is about the gender balance here, or the sexual balance between men and women. Is the rate of infection, by your estimate, the same among men as it was among women, or is there a difference?
Yes, it does seem to be the case that that there is an approximate balance between the two sexes. Kevin Sienna, who wrote this terrific book on the foul wards of London in between 1600 and 1800.
These are these wards which specialised in venereal infections.
Sorry?
Are these wards which specialised?
Yeah, so what you've got is...
Foul wards.
What Kevin Sienna's book showed for the first time was that hospitals and institutions were treating the pox. I think before he'd published his book in 2004, most people thought that hospitals wouldn't touch these morally tainted individuals on the whole, but he demonstrated no, there is clearly a lot of treatment going on. In the main hospitals that were offering treatment were St. Thomas's, St. Bartholomew's and Guy's Hospital, and they have large wards called foul wards. 20 to 30% of their beds are being devoted to treatment for the pox. So this is a big business. Those people entering those wards are paying for them, and they have to pay a guinea and a half on entry, quite a lot of money, to cover themselves, and they may have to pay a bit more if their treatment is protracted. The treatment was not cheap. Mercury salivation was the main treatment, and this costed. So what we find in these hospitals is there's about a 2-to-1 ratio of men to women. It tends to be men using the hospitals. They're more likely to have the resources to be able to pay for it. However, there are other institutions in London treating the pox. There is particularly the Lock Hospital, which is dedicated to the unsettled poor. So this is these people who don't have any form of poor law support, and they, if they have now believe they've got an incapacitating case of the pox, they can come to the Lock Hospital. And there we find about twice as many women as men turning up at the Lock Hospital. They tend to be rather young, in their late teens and very early 20s. The men in the Lock Hospital tend to be a little bit older. They're also unsettled men in London. So that's one major institution. And then the other big institution, which is where our new article has done some of its most important work, is to quantify how much treatment is being provided by the poor law in London. The largest parishes in London, like St. Pancras, which have thousands of people in them, have big workhouses with their own infirmaries. And these infirmaries, we've shown, are in fact treating, they also have their own foul wards. So they're treating the very poor who cannot afford the hospitals. And there again, we find twice as many women as men appearing in the foul wards of the workhouses.
This is fascinating. But could the foul ward of an infirmary, or the infirmary of a workhouse rather, could that sort of institution afford mercury? I mean, mercury wasn't cheap.
No, it wasn't. But they do seem to. This was considered to be the intriguing thing about the oddity to us today is that we of course know, thanks to modern science, we know that mercury on the whole will, although it's a heavy metal poison, it is toxic to the treponema, to the spirochete, but it's also toxic to the human host. It's very, very difficult to give the kind of a dose you would need to kill all the spirochetes in a body without also killing the human. So it's not really an effective form of treatment. There was a rather rational, it was rational for people at the time to believe that mercury did cure the pox. The reason for this is that a couple of reasons. One is the salivation that it caused. It's a poison for the body, and if you give it to people, they start copiously salivating in literally in pints. The body's trying to sort of saying, you know, what are you doing to me? Try and get this stuff out. That made sense to at the time that this the idea was that this salivation was causing the poison in the body to be evacuated, including the syphilitic poison or the pox poison, as they called it at the time. So it made sense in that sense, in those terms. It also made sense that it was a painful, horrible treatment because you'd been a naughty boy, naughty girl to get this. So, you know, the fact that you were undergoing pain in order to cure yourself sort of made sense as well to their cosmology. But more sort of rationally, as we would see it, because of the nature of the disease that we talked about at the beginning, that the secondary phase tends to last 2-3 months in most people and maybe a bit more in others. And because the salivation treatment was a 5-week minimum treatment, 5 to 6 to 7 weeks was the norm, residential, because you weren't fit to go anywhere while you were having the treatment. What would happen would be that people would start off by hoping that they'd only got the clap, which we would today call gonorrhea, which was a somewhat milder in its symptoms, and they would self-medicate. Once the secondary phase of pox came on and they started to feel really evil, they would probably eventually give up self-medicating, and they would have to sort of say, okay, I've really got to do something about this. This is driving me mad. They would go to present themselves for treatment, at which point they then get about 5 or 6 weeks of treatment. So the thing is that the secondary stage of the disease actually will tend to probably pass off during that 5-6 week period or very shortly afterwards. So the apparent observation being made by doctors and their patients was you get ill, you come in and have a 5-week treatment of mercury salivation, and then you get better. Yes. So it appeared, and the strange thing was that around this period in particular, the late 18th century, one of the very few things that doctors were really confident they had a proper cure for was this, was the pox with the mercury treatment. So the medical profession was, you know, really proud of this and thought this was at least one thing they could really do. I mean, smallpox vaccination was the other thing that they had it that was effective.
It's a very good example of the problem of correlation without causation.
Yes. Yeah.
But, and so how, if you're looking at a disease like this, how do you count syphilis cases? Are there any, is there any hard and fast evidence on the numbers we're looking at? I mean, you mentioned people have to decide to go to a hospital. You know, they may decide not to. They may avoid treatment because of shame and stigma. They may go into hospital with an illness of some kind that they think may be the pox. It may be misdiagnosed as the pox by doctors at the time. And you just mentioned yourself, people didn't know, couldn't distinguish between gonorrhea and syphilis. They thought they might be parts of the same disease. Or they
How
do you disaggregate these things that were stuck together in the minds of contemporaries and count syphilitics or syphilis-infected individuals, separately from other categories?
Yeah. Okay. Well, in some ways, one of the reasons I think why historians including quantitative historians have really not ventured into attempting this at all in the past is precisely because of the complexity of some of the things that you've just been talking about. So for this article to succeed, we had to come up with a probabilistic statistical method for counting cases that our peer reviewers were prepared to accept as valid. And so what we've done in this article is in effect to say that if given that to treat pox in this way was an expensive in many senses. It was expensive for the institutions that were providing it for free because mercury was not cheap and because they've got to house the people for several weeks. It's expensive for the individual because they have to put themselves out of circulation for several weeks, and this of course could be economically very problematic for many people. And of course it's, you know, it's physically painful to do it. But so what we're saying is that we believe that most of the people who were prepared to go that far and the doctors who were prepared to take them in and treat them for as much as 5 weeks, they probably did indeed have pox, or as we would call it, syphilis, rather than these many other conditions. The pox, the syphilis, was significantly more symptomatically painful and difficult to deal with than the other possible conditions, such as gonorrhea and chlamydia and soft chancre and all these other genital conditions that were around.
Because I think this is fascinating, because it shows that, you know, we sometimes talk about quantitative history, which makes it sound as if, you know, historians who are doing this kind of work are just working with numbers. But in fact, what you're doing, you're including in your assessment a whole set of, you know, very carefully contextualized assumptions about behavioral patterns.
Yeah, no, you have, I mean, especially to get, I mean, when historians are counting dead bodies, provided you're satisfied that the administrative system to take in and count them was a robust and a well-functioning one, then things are fairly straightforward. Although, of course, as soon as you're interested in the cause of death, things start getting much more complicated. But if you're dealing with a non-fatal disease manifestation like this, then yes, things you really have to know your stuff, so to speak. And this is where, you know, for me personally, teaming up with Kevin Sienna, who has, you know, spent years looking, reading very carefully into all the primary sources of the period and thinking carefully about what they're saying and so on. This is crucial in order to make the judgments that enabled us to come up with this method. So what we did was we excluded from all the hospital, the hospitals were where we had the highest quality, richest data, the admissions register data. First of all, we excluded anybody who was an outpatient. So if you came in with a venereal distemper, as they called it at the time, but you were classified as an outpatient, then you're not counted in our statistics. If you're an inpatient, you're only counted if you do stay in for a minimum of 35 days. So about 20% of the people we see in the register discharge themselves or are discharged in less than 35 days. So we don't count them. We assume that they had something that wasn't the pox or whatever. And there's a whole bunch of other things that we talk about in the article where we are not attempting to count all the people who might have had pox who were in other institutions like prisons and so on. Yeah. So we're sort of saying that what we're doing is we are constructing a kind of deliberately quite restrictive, conservative counting procedure in order to be reasonably confident that the figures that we eventually come out with are conservative minimum estimates of what was going on in London at the time, rather than, we're certainly not trying to egg it up at all, or, we're trying to produce a minimum.
It's the opposite of sensationalist, absolutely. In fact, the numbers may be, there's a penumbra of highly probable cases around your very conservative estimate of 20%. But this 20% estimate is it's a synchronic estimate, isn't it? It's an estimate of how many people at any one given moment are infected with syphilis in the London population. But it's perfectly in consonance, isn't it, with the observation made in an earlier study that perhaps they're not based on the kind of rigorous work that you and Kevin Siena have done, that the majority of urban men in London would probably have had a sexually transmitted infection at some point in their lives. That's possible, isn't it?
Yeah, so this is Ronald Trumbach, who probably did, he looked most, probably more carefully than anybody else at various sources that were available to him. And he came to that kind of conclusion, which he said sort of a majority of men in British cities would have had an infection with gonorrhea, at least, he said, which gonorrhea is much more infectious than syphilis. We would say on the basis of our work that given that gonorrhea is probably something in the region of 3 to 4 times more infectious than syphilis, it would be consistent with our findings to suppose that a majority of men in London would have had an STI at some point in their adulthood. It wouldn't be, I think, the case for other cities and towns in England at this time. I myself was able to mount one high quality study of the town of Chester, and that produced a figure of 8%. So a figure that's completely comparable in the way it's constructed with the one we've got for London. So the London figure is 21%, the Chester figure is 8%. So that doesn't suggest that in cities in general in Britain at this time and large towns that a majority of men would have had an STI, but it would be fair to say that that's what it looks like for London.
London is special.
And London is special. It's got a much, much bigger turnover of adults than any other city. And that's part of what's going on here. So that you mentioned that this was a synchronic figure of 20%. It's, as I mentioned earlier, I think it probably means that we unfortunately, one of the things we just do not have is a good measure of the churn of the population in London at this time. But we've got that there are signs that at least 20%, that would be a total minimum, and probably something more like 40% of adults between the age of 15 and 35 are mobile in some sense. They're either coming in or they're going out. The 20% figure only applies to maybe half or more of the population that is actually there all the time between the age of 15 and 35. But there's another half of the population, or up to a half, who are probably only there for a part of that time.
This churn of human populations really is one of the great bugbears, or one of the great problems to be solved for epidemiological studies, isn't it?
Demography works at its best when it can exclude migration, or when it has extremely high quality information about migration, which is often the administrative structure in the past that was weakest. We have censuses and we have vital registers of births and deaths, and they're the strong part of the data. Migration and mobility is often making things significantly more complicated for demographers, but is absolutely vital for to try to take it into account and understand it.
And this figure, 21%, which there's a certain shock value there, in that number. How does it compare with rates of sexually transmitted infection worldwide today, with HIV, for example, where there are still many countries which have a relatively high rate of infection with HIV? Are we looking at similar numbers?
Yes, I think again, HIV. AIDS infections are also subject to quite a lot of difficulty in how they're measured. We do cite at one point in one of our footnotes one of the countries that probably has a somewhat more secure, robust measurement system, South Africa, has recorded even in recent times rates of HIV/AIDS of up to similar figures of 20%. For its population. And HIV/AIDS is kind of has some similarities with syphilis in that it's actually quite a hard disease to get, unlike gonorrhea and chlamydia, which are terrifically infectious and quite easy to pass between people. Both HIV/AIDS and syphilis require some form of typically some kind of inoculation into the bloodstream, which is
through a lesion of some kind.
Yeah, which is not kind of so it's not going to happen. Individuals may have sex many times we've got James Boswell as probably a good example of this, of someone who records 19 episodes of what look like, because he, fortunately for us, he describes in some detail, it looks pretty certain that he's getting gonorrhea all the time. But he doesn't look to me like he's ever had he's very, very lucky. He never gets a dose of the pox. So these kind of levels of 20% of the pox are high. They're very high. They're getting towards, it's they could go higher, but they are high. And for instance, the first study I did of this subject back in 2014, looking at a slightly later period, the Edwardian period just before First World War, where we also have some very good sources of information, we can produce a figure exactly comparable to this one for the 1770s for London, and the figure for London at that time is 11%.
Yes.
So London's about half the rate just before the First World War that it was in the 1770s. Of course, it's a rather different entity by then. It's a much, much bigger city with masses of suburbs and so on.
And this, of course, this danger that infected men would infect women when they married them was one of the issues raised by Pankhurst.
Yes, the great scourge which she published in 2013, really, really put on the agenda the idea that irresponsible men were riddled with pox and were passing it to their wives and were a danger to the nation and to the, and it was part of the claim for the vote for women that men were irresponsible, too many of them, and women really needed the vote to stick up for themselves. It was a strong claim, and in fact reading the Scourge and finding that she was actually citing medical, very serious medical evidence at the time. It wasn't just her sort of being a polemicist. Reading the Scourge combined with one or two other things that I'd noticed about that period was what, to some extent, set me off on this research initially, because I thought, well, if Christabel Pankhurst is even half right with her claims that sort of large proportion, more than half of men were infected. If she's even half right, this is something that demographers and people studying population change and mortality and fertility really, really ought to be trying to find out about, not just ignore it, not just saying, oh, well, the data's not there, we just can't do anything, we ignore it.
Yes, among other reasons, because these diseases affect fertility, and so they can have a demographic impact.
Yes, so during the last few years, I've been looking at this in various ways. And last year, I published, I edited a book called The Hidden Affliction, which has many contributions by, wonderful scholars from across the world, studies of Africa and Australasia, the Pacific Islands, the ancient texts, and so on. And that came out of a conference here in Cambridge in 2015, where we got these scholars together. And one of the most intriguing things about that conference was I certainly started the conference with the strong belief that the oldest affliction of this kind was gonorrhea, because it's there as a term in the classics, in the ancient texts of the classical world, that syphilis was probably next in chronological appearance, because I knew that there's a big debate about whether or not it comes over with Columbus's crew, but it seems to be probably something that turns up in the early modern period. And then chlamydia is the kind of new kid on the block, that there'd been a famous epidemic of chlamydia in the 1960s and 70s and 80s. It was a big brouhaha about it and so on. So that's how I started my understanding of the history of these three diseases. And I think it's fair to say most of the other people at the conference did as well. And as we all gave our papers and reflected on them, we realized to our amazement that actually the oldest affliction was almost certainly chlamydia, that there is very, very good biological and zoological evidence to believe that chlamydia has been with us almost forever. And that, or many, many generations, that syphilis probably was an early modern eruption. And the new kid on the block may be gonorrhea, because the kind of microbiological research tracing its genomic history points towards as recently as the late 16th, early 17th century for its emergence. There is a big question mark over that, but anyway, that's where the science is at the moment. But also, one of the people at the conference, Rebecca Fleming, who is a classicist here in Cambridge, had a very, very good look at the usages of gonorrhea in the classical texts, and presented a splendid paper in which she argued that actually, if you look really carefully at the symptoms that are being discussed whenever they talk about the word gonorrhea, these are not the symptoms of what we would today define as gonorrhea.
Really, this is fascinating.
So the history of these three is upside down. It's not what we thought.
Where does anybody have any idea where something like gonorrhea would come from? I mean, how does a new organism emerge as a pathogen?
Well, chlamydia seems to be a very, very long-term hitchhiker on many, many, right? I mean, the thing is, there are many species have their own variants of chlamydia, including reptiles.
Koalas.
Yeah, koalas, famous. Very, you're right, you're an Australian, so you know this. Yes, koalas certainly have their chlamydia.
Never forget the koala.
Sorry?
Never forget the koala.
Yes, that's right. So there are actually, once one begins to realize it, there are some very good reasons to believe that chlamydia has been with us for a very long time. It's quite a complex, its life cycle is very complex. It couldn't possibly have suddenly appeared as recently as the mid-20th century.
Would gonorrhea have come from that zoonotic disease? Is that something the animal?
Gonorrhea is probably the trickiest one of all. And I think that we may well see quite a lot more evidence about gonorrhea. It's a very, very evolutionarily labile microorganism. It can adapt and morph very, very rapidly. So that's one reason why I'm a little bit cautious about these genomic studies, which are saying it's as recent as the 16th century. It may well be that there are variants of gonorrhea that no longer exist today that were actually there before that, and that's going to be very, very difficult to
know.
The syphilis one is, that's where there's a big, big debate. I mean, it would make the career of any archaeologist if they could demonstrate unequivocally that there was syphilis in Europe before 1492.
They could do, because you can find evidence of syphilis if people actually die of it in the treponemal lesions in skeletons, for example.
That's exactly right. So archaeologists are very busy working on this. Genomic biologists are also trying to see if they can extract sufficient DNA from skeletons to say something about this. If somebody could actually demonstrate it was definitely there in Europe.
I'm starting to think I chose the wrong branch of this discipline. But anyway,
well, that's very, very nice of you to say so. I think what you do is absolutely fascinating as well.
we're running out of time now, sir. Let's come now just finally to, do you think, I mean, I was fascinated by what you said about how before the First World War, the figures are probably much lower or considerably lower, possibly around half the estimate that you produced for the 18th century. Do you think this figure, 21%, has implications for our understanding today of sexual behavior? Because, I mean, the Times, who published a piece about your study, clearly thought it did. I mean, the headline that they chose read, "Top of the Pox, London, Sin City Past." So yes. do you think it does suggest?
Yes. Well, the other thing that I discovered about this period in the 1770s in another earlier article I produced, the one on Chester, was I was able in that article to look at rural Cheshire and northeast Wales, the area just around that, and the rates in that part of the country in the 17th century were incredibly low, 0.9%. So what we're seeing in the 1770s, according to this data, is the vast majority, 75% of the English population living in rural England with almost innocent of STIs, very, very, very low rates. You move to a town, a provincial town like Chester, and the chances rocket up from almost nothing to 8%. You move to the metropolis, to London, very fast growing, big international city with all sorts of opportunities, but also precarity there. And the rates double or more than double again to a higher rate than we see in London 110, 130 years later. What that means is that the rate of STIs across the entire population of England, although they're very high in London, is actually moderate, is only probably about 3.5% across the entire country. Mm. Whereas if you go forward to 1910, 14, that sort of period, although London's rate is only half of what it was in the 1770s, the general rate across the country is actually at 7.7%. It's because even in rural districts by 1910 to 14, you're seeing 4 to 5% rates, according to the earlier articles that I've done on this. So in other words, it's very polarized and disparate in the 1770s. London is London is looking like it certainly is Sin City, but that doesn't necessarily have implications for the wider rural society that it is a part of at that time. Whereas by the Edwardian period, although the levels in London have attenuated and become somewhat more, a little more moderate, the English population as a whole, there is STIs spread really all around it now at a moderate level. What does this say about sexuality and so on? There is a big debate amongst historians. There are some historians who would like to argue that there is a kind of a sexual liberation revolution in the second half of the 18th century, and that it's focused on London, and that we should celebrate this. I think both Kevin Sienna and I are pretty skeptical about that. We think that an awful lot of what's going on is basically pretty exploitational, is to do with poverty, and really rather a gender polarized society and culture at that time, and that by the early 20th century, the oddity is that the lowest rates that we can see are amongst the kind of middle of society, the skilled working class, the lower middle class, the sort of communities, particularly textile working communities and mining communities, the sort of heart and soul of the English working class. By the time we get to the 1911, they are showing amongst the lowest rates of STIs. So these are sort of stable working class communities are doing their sexuality is moderate or restrained or chaste, let's say. So I think that statistics can get you so far, but it really starts forcing you to speculate a bit without the kind of wonderful rich material that you can get from cultural historians, from medical historians, from gender historians, social historians. And the real prize, as far as I'm concerned, and what we were driving at in this book called The Hidden Affliction, is to put all these approaches together.
Yes.
And then you can get so much more. You can really start to, the cultural the cultural evidence without the quantitative evidence is rather speculative in one sense. The quantitative evidence without the cultural and social evidence is speculative in another sense.
That's really interesting. I mean, I was going to try and draw out some inference like that, but you've just said it better than I could possibly have done, that we need all the different parts of history to make sense of these complex human phenomena in the past, as indeed in the present. And coming back to the present just very briefly before we close, I wanted to ask you, I mean, we've been talking about how one extracts robust findings from, ambiguous and complex data. How do you think we've been coping with the current pandemic? Are you impressed by the way we've managed the numbers, our grip on the statistics of the COVID-19 phenomenon?
Mm. Well, I haven't been very impressed with what's been going on in this particular country, in the UK. There has been quite a mishmash of statistics put out of varying kinds, and it does look rather like the government was, you know, the kind of absence of statistics about what was going on in hospitals for quite a good long time, and then the sort of adding them back in rather late in the day, that did not look good to, if I put my scientific spectacles on, it looked like there was some quite sort of underhand politics going on there. On the whole, because we are now in societies with good reporting mechanisms and so on, then the statistics, I am confident that at the end of the day, when we have a proper commission into all this and investigate retrospectively, we will know, we will have very good evidence on exactly what did go on and how it went on and what the death rates were in and the infection rates in care homes, which seems to have been a particularly particularly difficult part of what happened in this epidemic, certainly in this country. So I think we will have the stats. I think that it is difficult for the public because the raw figures, which are kind of trooped out, are not easy to interpret on their own. There's this figure that's been used a lot more recently, which is the excess deaths figure,
yes,
which is probably the best figure overall to go with, because the excess death figures, in a sense, captures aspects of increased fatality that are due to this COVID epidemic, but may not be directly due to the COVID-19 microorganism, because, of course, it's put such stress on our healthcare system and indeed on our whole society.
Yeah,
that that there is increased morbidity and indeed increased mortality in our in all of our societies in such a way that when we come to the really big reckoning, which is inevitably going to be, why the hell was it when even a man like Bill Gates, who is no expert, 5 years ago in a TED talk could, you know, very clear-eyed say, this is a major, major threat. We have to take this seriously. And when we have had in this country repeated government exercises almost annually until about 2015, and then the last big one, the Cygnus one in 2016, you know, really preparing for pretty much racing certainty that something like this was going to happen at some point. And it's been 100 years since the last big one. So in a sense, it was almost more likely to, you know, we were getting very near to it. So
yes, this is a point, isn't it? That this is not, a pandemic on this scale is not a common event, but it's not a so-called black swan either.
No, it's very
predictable.
It's very predictable. I had to laugh when I was 2 or 3 months ago. I don't think it was a government minister, I think it was a backbencher, was sort of defending the government's record by saying, you know, but this is a once in 100 years event. You know, how could we be prepared for it? And I was thinking, yeah, funny that, isn't it? Because the last event like this was, guess what, 101 years ago.
Halley's Comet, sort of rare and yet predictable.
Yes, yeah, and governments really have a duty to, I mean, you know, 99.9% of the population, they won't be thinking about this. Why should they? Something that happens once every 50 or 100 years. But governments, with the advice of medical science, epidemiology and probabilistic risk assessment and so on, it is their, you know, I mean, the number one job of a sovereign state is to protect its population. Always has been. This is one of the most obvious crucial protection, you know, in a society which is globally trading and in global exchange. That's the kind of economy that we have nowadays. You know, we are in a global microbial environment. And I mean, most people who are reasonably well educated know that. And it's a government function to take very seriously the protections that are needed. And as far as we can see, that's what was happening until about 2016. Then, you know, we've got this problem of PPE that was 5 years out of date, and not enough of it, and so on. And this really, really should have been there.
On this sobering note, we can come to a close, and it just remains for me to thank you, Simon Tretter, for joining me in this fascinating conversation about sexually transmitted infection in 17th and 18th century London, the connections with the present, and the complexity and fascination of dealing with ambiguous numbers to arrive at robust estimates of how people suffered in the past and from which diseases. Thank you very much for joining us.